Well, it's good to see everybody here today. This is really going to be a busy month for these guys here, because this is Vaisakh month. And the full moon day of May is when Siddhartha, the future Buddha, was born, when he achieved enlightenment, and when he passed away into nirvana. And we celebrated our Buddha's birthday last month. We celebrated Hanumatsuri, which is the Japanese Buddha's birthday, and they went from lunar calendar to solar calendar, so it ended up in April instead of May. And every Theravada temple in Los Angeles will be having a Buddha's birthday celebration. And one of the things with the Buddha's birthday celebration, you invite the monks. So Reverend Shanti has all sorts of invitations. He's going to be taking his monks with him. And they'll be celebrating for 5 weeks the Buddha's birthday. And I was thinking, why is this important? Why is the Buddha's birthday so important? Why is he an example that we could follow if we want to? And I think the reason is because he did something that hadn't been done for a really long time. He became free. And he never had to live in samsara again. Now, that may not be a big deal for most of us here, because all we know is life in samsara. Samsara is where birth and death occur. Samsara is filled with impermanence. Nothing lasts longer than a moment. Nothing. And our whole life, we're chasing happiness and running away from sadness, and we're trying to have careers and not be unemployed. We want a lot of money so we can live the way we want to, but we never get enough. That's why I thought having a maximum salary would be a really good way to go. We have a minimum wage, why not have a maximum wage? That way we'd all know how much money is enough. Because does anyone ever have enough money? No. But if there was a maximum wage, they would. Then they could turn their interests towards something else besides just making money. But it didn't go over well. So we're faced with this, with the situation of trying to figure out, number one, what it means to be free. And when the Buddha talked about being free, It wasn't free to do anything you want. It wasn't free to live anywhere you want. It was freedom from suffering. It was freedom from the dissatisfaction of life, from that little icky feeling we all get sometimes when things just aren't going our way, which is most every day. And we'd like to find a refuge. We'd like to find some place that sort of gives us peace and calm in the midst of the hurricane called life. And it's difficult. So the Buddha laid out a whole series of steps, the Eightfold Path. And we need to follow the steps. And if we follow the steps, what happens, first of all, is we start to sync with the unfolding of our reality. And I found this to be just a fascinating concept, that we have this sort of moral foundation, the first few steps of the Eightfold Path that we try to follow. And one level, it's the easiest thing to follow, and at another level, it's the most difficult. The easy part is, it's understandable, and it can be defined, and it can be understood in a relative way, unlike meditation. So the Buddha said, you know, you got to do these five things, the five precepts that a Buddhist takes. And in doing these five precepts, not to take life, not to take what is not given, not to indulge in sexual misconduct, not to speak unskillfully, not to consume intoxicants, in doing these five things, we sort of jump into the flow of life. Not against it, but with it. And there's something called synchronicity. Carl Jung talked about synchronicity, where things just sort of fall into place miraculously, unexpectedly. And the five precepts allow us to have more synchronicity than not. It allows us to go into the natural flow rather than against the flow. And all of a sudden, there's a parking place, except in Koreatown. There's a restaurant open with good food, and there's a table waiting for you. And you just sort of go, wow, this is so cool. I'm synced. I feel like I'm in the flow. Things are going well. And then you break one of the precepts, and there's no table, there's no parking place. And I like that idea. I like that there's a payoff immediately when you start practicing the five precepts. It also lays the foundation for transcendence. And the problem with meditation sometimes is we literally do transcend who we are. But in doing that, we seem to give ourselves permission to do things that may be unskillful because we see the big picture and they don't. And you hear these stories about people who are Zen masters or Zen teachers who sort of bend the rules a little bit when it comes to their students and are amazed that people are so affected in a negative way because they're doing what seemed to be obvious because they have a transcendent view of the universe. But yet, if they had followed simply the five precepts, they wouldn't find themselves in trouble. They wouldn't find themselves in that situation. And it speaks to us as well, because each one of us has to live with other people, sometimes intimately, sometimes in groups, sometimes just in the city. And there's so many of us, and we all look at things so differently. And yet, if we follow those five precepts, we can pretty much blend in and be invited to live next door to people who live around us, who live in Los Angeles, because we are practicing not to kill them, we are practicing not to steal from them, etc., etc. So what the Buddha said, I think, makes a lot of sense. He says, first of all, you have to figure out how to live with other people, because you can't be a recluse your whole life. Even if you go on a 2.5-year meditation retreat, people are feeding you. They're bringing you food to the little cootie. And I know in Sri Lanka they have meditation camps, if you will, and lay people aren't allowed to go in there, just for monks. They don't want to be disturbed. They've got very serious business ahead of them to figure out who the heck they are. And so the lay people come to the sima, to the boundary, and leave the food, and then they leave, and then the monks come and get the food. So that may be good, but now you still have to live with the other monks who are meditating. And can you imagine being in a monastery and not liking the guy next to you for the rest of your life? You know, he either doesn't eat correctly, he doesn't smell good, he doesn't do what you think he should do, and he's your partner in a very real way for the rest of your life. Talk about nightmare situation. So practicing the precepts, allowing us to live with other people in a skillful, harmonious way, and then going into changing our mind. Because the whole problem with life is the way we experience it. You know, life just is. It just does what it does. It unfolds. And we have to interpret it. We have to make sense of it. We have to give it meaning. And in my last talk, I talked about the meaning of life. What is the meaning of life? I love that question. And I started to investigate it for months before I made my first talk on the meaning of life. So the meaning of life is to give life a meaning. That's it. It has no meaning in itself. How are we going to give our life a meaning? Well, as a Buddhist, the equation needs to have suffering. Our life has no meaning without suffering if we're a Buddhist. So the first level of meaning that a Buddhist would get from life would be, I'm suffering. It's so difficult. It's so unsatisfactory. I'm suffering all the time. It's become the meaning of my life to suffer. And that's when the Buddha shows up and says, young man, young woman, I can change the meaning of life for you. Rather than my life is filled with suffering, this life is a stepping stone to the end of suffering. That is a radical shift in understanding your life. From I am suffering to this is a stepping stone to the end of my suffering. And an even greater vision would be in the Mahayana, this is a stepping stone to the end of all suffering. And I will be a contributing factor in that end of suffering. Wow, how cool is that? So now we go into the meditation because our body doesn't suffer. Our body feels pain. Our mind suffers. And now we have to cultivate our mind. We have to change the way it thinks. We have to change the way it experiences the world around us. And the first aspect is right effort. And right effort has nothing at all to do with the body. It has everything to do with the mind. I will abandon unskillful thoughts. I will prevent unskillful thoughts from arising. I will develop skillful thoughts. I will maintain skillful thoughts once they have arisen. So we go to our Buddhist dictionary, skillful thought, page 34. Skillful thought, generosity, compassion, wisdom. Unskillful thought, greed, hatred, delusion. Okay, cool, got that. Right effort is, first of all, to figure out how you're thinking, what value you're going to give it, what box you're going to put it in. So when I got those 8 Hostess cupcakes individually wrapped from Food for Less, I was filled with greed and loving it. Because I was going to eat every one of them with a big glass of milk. But then I thought to myself, you're cultivating. You're cultivating a mind of generosity and compassion. How can you possibly eat all 8? I don't know, but I did anyway. So it's a matter of gradually encouraging yourself to go into the direction of generosity. Maybe from 8 you go to 6. You can give 2 away. There's no hurry. We have many lifetimes ahead of us. We have this lifetime to practice. And I know, living in Los Angeles, we're all in a hurry. We all want immediate results. We all want instant gratification. But the Buddhist path, as I understand it, is not one of those places you're going to find instant gratification. It's a gradual deepening of wisdom and compassion. It's a gradual way of deciphering what this world means to you and how to use it to your advantage. And to your advantage means how to end your suffering forever. Not temporarily, but forever. Permanent. Now we come to the meditation aspect after the right effort. We have 44 different kinds of meditation that we can do according to the Visuddhimagga. Buddha Gosha, 5th century, wrote this meditation manual, 900 pages. You can download it on my website. You can peruse it and memorize it and enjoy it if you can stay awake while you're reading it, because it's not very exciting. But it goes into great detail on how to find a teacher, how to find your object of meditation, what to do with it, what the path looks like when you're meditating, what to watch out for, what to encourage. It goes into all those aspects of your meditation practice. So it's priceless. But do we need to do that? Do we need, are we going to be, you know, professors of meditation and profoundly speak on the 44 kinds of meditation and all aspects that pertain to them? Probably not. So I would suggest doing meditation on breath. It's looked at as both important in Vipassana and Samatha meditation, and you always have it with you. It's not like you have a special little icon you have to have when you meditate, or you have to light candles, or you have to have the right kind of incense, or you can't meditate, or the cushion. You just need to breathe. And if you breathe, then you can meditate. And that means you can meditate all day long if you want. You don't have to sit down, because you're breathing when you're walking, you're breathing when you're standing, you're breathing when you're sitting. And what do we learn from that breath? Well, we learn, number one, that our mind has a real difficulty of watching the breath, because it's really boring to watch the breath. We don't even become aware of the breath until we can't breathe. And then it's just fear and dread of death that keeps us attached to the sensation of breath. But it's subtle and ever-changing. It's just like our life. sometimes we're shallow breaths and sometimes it's deep breaths, and sometimes life is shallow and sometimes life is deep. We have all sorts of metaphors we can use about our life and our breath that work really well. So we sit down and we watch the breath and we get deeper and deeper into our concentration. And now if you're going to do Vipassana meditation, you only want momentary concentration. You don't want sustained concentration. Momentary. You're just like taking a snapshot. And then you go into reflection. But I prefer the sustained concentration of samatha meditation, going deep inside that object of meditation, where happiness and bliss arises in your body and your mind. So the five characteristics of samatha meditation found in the first jhana are applied thought and sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. They arise because you're concentrating on the object of meditation, which in this case is our breath. If we continue to concentrate and focus even deeper on the breath, we lose the applied thought and sustained thought. It's no longer necessary. Now our mind simply rests on the object of meditation without any effort on our part. And we have a greater sense of happiness and a greater sense of bliss, physical pleasure, and a greater sense of equanimity. But if we want to go deeper, because Buddhism is a path of renunciation, you don't gain anything on the Buddhist path. You just get rid of everything that prevents you from realizing you've always been there, nirvana. You got to give something up, and now you're going to give up the pleasure of the body. Well, the other side of pleasure is pain, so if you can give up pleasure, you're going to be giving up pain as well. But then you really can't give that stuff up because it's hardwired just to happen, whether you want it to or not. So what you got to give up is your attachment to pleasure and your aversion to pain. You have to come to the place in the middle where you have no clinging and no pushing. And you can do it. It takes a long time. Once you've done it, once you've given up your attachment to pleasure and your aversion to pain, now you got happiness and sadness. Because if you're going to be happy, sadness is sure to follow. And now you have to give up your attachment to happiness and your attachment to sadness and find that place in the middle. Buddha called this the middle path. And if you can do that, you only have one characteristic left in your object of meditation. And that characteristic is perfect balance, equanimity, not choosing sides, one or the other. And you rest in this sense of profound acceptance of the way things are. Everything is just perfect now, while you're sitting on that cushion and finally in that last jhanic stage. Wow. And then Reverend Shanti rings the bell and it's over and you have to get up and go out that door and you're faced with samsara again and maybe the 405 and you don't know if you can handle it because you've seen the possibility of your life on that cushion and it was glorious and now you're on the 405 and it is hell. And you say, I'm going to have to practice more because I want that part to be permanent. That pleasure, that happiness, that bliss, that equanimity. Fine. And with enough lifetimes of practice, absolutely. And none of us know how many lifetimes we've already been practicing. It could be 1,000 or 1,000,000, you know. But we keep forgetting that we lived before, and this always seems like the first time and the only time. And we practice and we practice and then we die. But there's something planted in our vibhanga consciousness, our storehouse consciousness, and those are the seeds of our practice, the seeds of the momentum of our practice that will carry us to the next lifetime, to the next lifetime, and ultimately realize our nirvana, which is what Siddhartha did, and that's why we celebrate the full moon day of May, because it said on that day he realized those 100, if not thousands, of lifetimes of practice came to fruition on the full moon day of May. And he achieved his perfection not by going someplace, but by realizing he had already been there, and what prevented him from that realization was his greed, his hatred, and his delusion. And that had been purified through the cultivation of meditation, and now he stands as a perfect man, as an example of what it means to be perfect in the human realm. He never became a god, which disappoints some. He just became a perfect human. You know, he was always generous. He was always caring and kind. And he was always wise and insightful into the true nature of the suffering of those he talked to. And because he could see at least 100,000 past lifetimes of their life, he knew exactly what to say. So don't be surprised if you're reading the ancient text and somebody comes and meets the Buddha and the Buddha says like five words and he becomes enlightened. Because the Buddha knew exactly the five words he needed to say to make this guy enlightened, because he could see the 100,000 past lifetimes when those five words weren't said. Yeah. So have we lost that teacher? Yes. You're not going to find him anyplace. And you're not going to be able to ask him any questions. He won't be able to give you your five words. But what he left behind is the Dharma, the teachings, the way he did it. The way he did it. And I always get a little nervous when people ask me what I think and what I think they should do, because I don't have a clue. I can tell you what I'm doing, and I can tell you how well it's working or not working, but I can never tell you what to do, because you have a radically different karma than I do, and experiences and education, and what I might say could be the exact wrong thing for you and the right thing for this person over here, but that person didn't ask me. So I got to be so careful. That's why I generally just talk about myself. It could be boring for some. But I give myself permission to talk about myself, because that way if I'm wrong, I'm wrong according to me, in my life, in my circumstances, in my reality. So theoretically, it should only hurt me or help me if I try to understand me. And now as I age and get to the senior me, I posted on Facebook, Head Monk, IBMC. I got a letter the other day, Head Monk, IBMC. So I'm thinking of changing it. I think I'm going to call myself Senior Monk, IBMC. The old guy. that might work better. And in being a senior monk, what you start to find is that the things that really excited you in the beginning don't excite you so much anymore. You're gung-ho to get enlightenment. Now you're just gung-ho to get up in the morning and find the meditation cushion. You know, it's just, sometimes that's enough. And you've got your daily chores to do. Some of the monks will be cleaning the bell tower. Some will be vacuuming. I'll be feeding the cats. Reverend Shanti will be figuring out how to pay the next bill. We have all these little things that we do to keep IBMC open and viable. And yet, there's always something else we could do. There's always a little bit more energy we can use to do it. And we're all getting older. And it's just like, so now I've got this much energy, and in 5 years, how much less energy will I have? And that's why it's so important when you're young, and that's a relative term, to just practice as much as you can. Because one day you'll be old and you may not want to practice as much as you did before, or you might not be able to practice as much as you did before. So every day is the first day of our practice. Every day is a day to challenge ourselves to stay connected to this practice. The meaning of our life has gone now from I am suffering to I am going to find the end to suffering. And we celebrate the birth, enlightenment, and death of one who laid out the path for us. Never told us what to do, only told us what he did in great detail. And it's always up to us to follow it or not. Do we need more Buddhists in the world? I've often said the only people who should ever practice Buddhists are people that suffer, which may be everybody. So have a wonderful Vaisak this month, the full moon day of May. When that full moon happens, wherever you are, just look up and say, today is the day that changed the world. Thank you for showing up today and listening. Does anybody have anything they'd like to comment on or speak about? Nam wants to applaud. Good. Okay. Well, everybody's smiling, so that's a good sign. Thank you.